You are listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. I am your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is author Abigail Kim. Hi, Abigail. Welcome to Accents.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be here, and I've been watching your progress and what you've been doing in the last 10 years, and it's just remarkable, and I'm so proud of you.
Thank you so much. We've had conversations on Accents a few times over the years, and it seems to me that every time there is more and more to talk about.
Yes, I started when I started my writing career, I wrote poetry, and it was very bad poetry. So I figured I was better at writing mysteries, which is what I do now.
Tell the listeners of Accents, who is Mona Moon?
Mona Moon, that is a new series I started. I thought it was just going to be a trilogy. And it was so popular, I'm now writing it the 15th book. And she's a 1930s character. And I love history, so I insert real people and events into the storyline. And then at the back of the book, I put an addendum giving more information about these people and the events, so it will make the book seem richer and fuller. Because I can't explain everything in what is supposed to be a piece of pleasure fiction. So I put the addendum at the back. And if people want to read it, they can. If they don't, they don't have to. But anyway, I love writing about the 30s. I love what was going on in the United States. A lot of turmoil, pretty similar to what is going on now. We were in the Great Depression. We were heading into World War II. And Mona is an heiress. She was a cartographer who worked in the Middle East mapping and the Zagros Mountains. And she inherited this fortune from her uncle. She goes back to the United States. And she has to, part of the will says she has to live in Moon Manor in Lexington, Kentucky. So everything takes place in Kentucky. Sometimes she goes off to different countries, but I just love writing about the times, what was going on in Kentucky at that time, and what was going on in the world. It's really enriching to write about this.
So it's cozy mystery, but history based.
Yes. It's an historical mystery, and that is the subgenre of mysteries, and it's a very particular niche. And I tell you, I have to have two people go after me, especially my husband, who checks all the historical facts, because if I get something wrong, believe me, I hear about it.
Well, not only historically, but also you need to keep continuity within a series. How do you do that?
You know, I keep a Bible, what writers call, you know, we write everything down, the characters and everything, and make what we call the writer's Bible. I keep that. So I have to refer, because after 14 books, I kind of lose thread of who's who, especially if they're minor characters. So I have to flip back to see. And I use reappearing characters because some of them are just so much fun. I can't let go of them. And Mona is a rabble rouser. She is a modern woman. And in Kentucky at that time, she was not much appreciated because it was a very traditional city and they did not want women at that time. You know, at that time, they were still trying to repeal the 20th Amendment. They were trying to bring disconnect women from voting. Was that the 20th or 19th Amendment? Whatever. It was the 19th Amendment, 1920. And they were trying to repeal it in Kentucky. And there was a nationwide movement to repeal the amendment to let women vote. And I bring all that. But at the same time, one of the country's most notorious madams, the Madam of Houses of Ill Repute, Belle Breeson, was still alive, and she's a great friend of Mona. So I like to mix these characters in and bring a lot of texture to the story.
Do you have a favorite supporting character, recurring character?
Well, gosh, there's so many of it of them. Let me think. Well, she has a man who works for her now, but he was trying to bring her down. His name is Rupert Hunt, and he's just a scallywag and a rake, and he's no good, but she uses him. She hired him because he was so good at being dishonest, and she uses him as a spy. And I enjoy him because he's very witty and he's very funny, and I like to bring him in certain of the books. And then of course her husband Robert Farley, who's a lord, an English lord, and there's a diminutive African American man who works as a detective at the Phoenix Hotel, which was the most popular hotel in Lexington at the time. His name is Jelly Bean Martin. And he is a very educated man, but of course he's not allowed to go beyond certain job accomplishments because he's African American, and he's hired as a detective, and he Mona pays him for information, and he is a delightful character, and I love to have her talk with him. They talk about Greek mythology a lot.
Love it. What is the latest Mona title that is out?
Murder Under a Bitter Moon. It takes place here in Lexington right before Derby Week, the Derby Day. And I have in it Ed Bradley, as you know, was one of the leading horsemen of the time. He owned Idle Hour Farm, and he had four Kentucky Derby winners. And I have Alice Roosevelt Longworth making an appearance because she always comes as Mona's guest to the Derby, and she was the daughter of President Roosevelt. And she always said of her father, "My father, Teddy Roosevelt, loves to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the baby at every christening." And Dorothy Parker's going to show up. I haven't written about Dorothy Parker before, but she and Alice Roosevelt Longworth battled in public about politics all the time because Alice was a Republican and Dorothy Parker was a left-leaning Democrat. So I enjoy talking about politics, what's going on all the time. I just enjoy writing about history in a fun way that people can gain knowledge and be entertained. I can't tell you how many young people I've talked to, and they don't know history. And it kind of like scares me. So if this is the way I can get history into people's hands, then I enjoy it.
What's next for Mona?
Well, I don't know. We're getting into World War II. I guess she'll go. Her husband owns an estate in England. I guess she'll follow her husband to England, and we'll see what happens there. And I'm sure she'll take in refugee children coming from Europe. I plan for her to do that. She's got a big estate. She can take them in and just talk about, one thing, one of the reasons I love history so much, my parents lived through 15 years of hell. They lived through the Great Depression. And then as the Depression was lifting, they headed right into World War II. And my dad was out Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And both of them would tell me stories of what it was like to live in the Depression. My mother in the 60s would still cry about President Roosevelt. And I said, "Mother, that man's been dead for over 20 some years." And she goes, "You don't know what it was like. We were starving. You don't know what it was like." And from them, I get a whole oral history of a living history of what it was like. And it was 15 years of just having terrible things happen to this country. And then with just determination and drive, just pushing their way out of it. I really find these people remarkable.
Have you ever thought of writing a history book without the fiction?
No, that's never occurred to me. Most of, yeah, I just don't think I have the background to write a very serious book about history. I could write a lot of anecdotal stories, what my parents told me, and I could do that. But I find what my parents went through, We were so spoiled in the 60s and 70s. These men came back from World War II and they believed public education was their birthright for their children. And they worked and worked and worked to push us through college. And we just considered them old fogies and their ideals horrible. And now that I'm their age, I realize what these people sacrificed for us.
What an interesting shift in perspective.
Wisdom does come with age.
I have lived long enough to be able to change my mind about a few things now and to see my parents' perspective also. What kind of research does it go in writing one of those books?
Well, of course, I rely quite a bit on what my parents talked about, and they always were big about telling stories. Also, my father loved history himself, and he could tell you he never graduated from high school, but he could tell you what senator voted for what bill. He knew exactly what was going on with foreign policy. He was very informed. My mother barely graduated from high school. She loved to go see movies and she would skip school. But if I made anything lower than a B, boy, I really got in hot water. I mean, that was my job to get good grades. That was my job. So, and my mother, who could not drive, would take me on the bus down to, at that time, there weren't hubs of libraries. There was only a main library, and that was in Cincinnati. And we would go on the bus, go over the river, because I lived in northern Kentucky, and she would get satchels, or not satchels, but shopping bags of books. And I can remember, I still remember the sound of them stamping, sound of them stamping on the little card that goes in and the smell of the library. And she would buy me book after book after book and just read to me and say, "You're going to read this book." And then when I finished all my books, we'd go back over the river again and take the books back and get another couple shopping bags full of books. And then I remember she bought me book series that was very popular at the time. She bought me, the Happy Hollister mystery series. It was a children's mystery series. And I got a book every month. Oh my God, I was so excited to get that through the mail. For a kid like 8 or 9 to get up their own mail, oh my God, that was so exciting. And I still have those books today. I just wouldn't part with them for the world.
And who is Josiah Reynolds?
Josiah is my flagship mystery series. I started writing about her 20 years ago. I tell you, I didn't know if it was going to make it. That was the beginning of all this technology that we have now. I didn't understand what a Kindle was. Somebody had to explain. I could think of why would somebody want to read it on some sort of tablet rather than a book? I didn't understand the concept. But anyway, she is a middle-aged woman who's disabled. She lives on a farm, and as we start out, she her husband has left her, and she has this rundown farm, and she is trying to make ends meet, and she has all these quirky friends. And the first book, she's a beekeeper, like I was a beekeeper. I was a beekeeper for many, many years and sold honey, quite a bit of honey. And I worked at a farmer's market, Lexington Farmers Market, for many, many years. So everything I say about beekeeping and what goes on at a farmer's market is pretty accurate. And so I kept having dreams about her, this character who just wouldn't let me be. She wanted to be born. So I just started writing about her, and I wrote my fr I'm going to do some shameless promotion, Death by Honeybee. And that was my first book. And I had a local person, Cricket Press, do the cover for me because I wanted an original cover, and they did a fantastic job. And it just took off about this beekeeping. People seem to be very fascinated by beekeeping and this woman who is middle-aged. I think a lot of middle-aged women kind of looked up to her, and her character resonated with them because she's not necessarily a nice person. She's a good person. But she's not necessarily nice. She's very sarcastic and she doesn't like to take up on any people and she's always getting into mischief. And of course, she's always stumbling over dead bodies.
20 years. How well do you know her by now?
Well, I know her pretty darn well. I know her better than Mona. Mona's young. I can remember being young, but I don't know what it's like being young in the 1930s. But Josiah, I know her. I know how she's going to react. I know what she's going to wear, and I know what she's going to think. And I would love to be friends with Josiah. I would love for her to be my best friend.
How do you keep that series fresh for yourself?
Well, let's see. We've gone through three boyfriends. I just fantasize. Okay, I'm her age. I've got her disability. What are my dreams at this age? What are my fantasies? What kind of mischief do I want to get in? What kind of excitement do I want to have? And I just go with that. They're basically fantasies.
That's wonderful. People, can always find more things to include in their fantasies.
I think so, and I think that's why so many older women like her. I get so many emails and I get cards and letters from people saying, my mother was in hospice, and I read your book to her, and she just loved it and gave her great comfort because Josiah is also going through physical manifestations. And I tell you, that means more to me than anything.
And you have international audience.
I think so. Yes. I just sold, I always look to see on the dashboard of all the different pay sites I had where I'm selling books. And this month, Japan was a big country that I sold a lot of books. And I was going, now who's reading my books in Japan? And but somebody is.
Tell us about the latest Josiah Reynolds title.
Well, the last book I just a few months ago was Death by Mistake. And I went to the Jessamine County Fair last year. I went to see the cow judging and looked at the, all the different baby judging contests and all these different events they have. And I decided I wanted that to be the cover of Death by Mistake. And I think it's one of the best covers of this book. The covers of these books are absolutely fantastic. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to brag about it, but I give an ideal to Cricut Press and Miss Sarah, who does the artwork, sends me back a sketch, and I tell her yay or nay, and she just seems to know what's in my mind, visualizing in my mind. Anyway, so and it's about Josiah's current boyfriend, who's a forensic psychologist. Dumps her for an old high school flame, and she's of course depressed about that. And but being Josiah, she goes on, and they stumble across. She stumbles across a dead body, and but then she meets a lawyer who's from Louisville, her age, and they're kind of bantering things about. So it's a kind of romantic, and but still has the mystery element in it. And of course, we go along to Lexington. I always have to talk about horses and stuff like that because that is Lexington.
Horses and bees.
Horses and bees. And I tell you, I love honeybees. And anyone who's listening to this, do not get rid of dandelions in your yard. The bees need the dandelions, wild violets, any other thing that crocuses, anything else that pops up in your yard in the spring. Don't get rid of it. Don't spray it. These bees need it, and we desperately need honeybees.
What can bees teach us about how to live?
Well, bees are mostly female. They are a community and they have a structure of behavior. When they first come out of their little cubicle, which is made of wax, they are called house bees and they immediately clean up their area and they attend the queen. And then they go down as they get older, go down to the entrance, and then they start becoming guard bees and they start receiving honey from worker bees. The worker bees are the end of their cycle. They go out into the world, gather nectar from honey, I mean, nectar from flowers, and bring it back. and give it, deposit it with the guard bees who then, and other house bees who then take it up and put it in cells, and then they cover it with wax. Now, where does the wax come from? It comes from their bodies. They are born with wax on the bottom of their bodies, their little tummies, and they will pull it out and chew it and then mold it to cover things and to make new wax, new octagon cells. So they are a society that is defensive, cooperative, and seemingly universal. I love honeybees. And they can see color, they recognize faces. If I went to open up a hive, the humming would come up, and I could tell by the humming if they were angry or they were in a good mood. And if the humming was not quite right, I would put the cover back on because I can only take up to 5 stings. And after that, I thought, well, they're just in a pissy mood, and I'm not going to fool with them. Now, if somebody, when I open the hive, would come along, they immediately get angry. I mean, the humming is just different because they recognize the beekeeper's face. And this is a stranger. This is a threat if somebody else comes along. So I immediately would put the cap back on. Now, the legend is that if something happens to the beekeeper and the beekeeper is not able to take care of these insects, then someone has to come and announce to the bees that the beekeeper is ill and will not be attending, or the beekeeper is dead. That is a tradition. And we even carry that in Kentucky today. There is a symbolic relationship between the beekeeper and the bees, sort of like a rider and a horse or a man and his dog. There's a symbolic relationship there that is based on trust.
That's amazing. Fascinating.
When I worked in at the farmer's market, and the flowers, I always had flower ladies around me. And of course, people in Lexington keep hives on their rooftops. So the bees would come down for the flowers and try to pollinate them. And they would also, when you cap honey or when you bottle honey, you get little bits of honey on your bottles that you can't see with the human eye. But the bees would start landing on my bottles, my honeybees. And people would just, oh God, they get so hysterical. So I would say, look, they're not going to bother you if you don't bother them. And I would pick one up with my finger. And honeybees are furry. That's the one thing you can identify them as furry. And I would stroke it. And I said, if you don't breathe on them and you are very calm, they will not sting you. And then I'd flick it off like that and go fly, go fly, go away, go away. And I would sit, I had about 30 hives one time, and I would sit outside and they would come and land on me. And they would, get the pollen from their legs and put it in their pollen basket. And they would sit around, they walk around, and then they decide I wasn't really a flower. But I think they recognized my smell and then they just fly off. They never stung.
Did you give them names, either the, not the, maybe the queens or the various hives?
The queens are vicious. Let me put it in such a way. Okay, let's say the workers decide there's going to be more than one queen, or the queen's getting old, or maybe she's injured, or they decide to make multiple queens. So the first queen that emerges from her cell, and the cell looks like a peanut. When she comes out of her cell, she will smell, or somehow through the chemicals that these cells produce, she will find the other queens and she will sting them to death. Then she will fly out to what is called a drone colony and mate with all these different drones from other hives. And she will then have enough seed to fly back to her, that is, if a wasp or a bird doesn't catch her, fly back to the hive, and she will know instinctively which hive she came from, reemerge it, and set up as the laying queen. The old queen, if she's still functioning, will chirp. She'll lose weight, chirp, and take a whole contingent of worker bees or house bees with her and leave the hive and try to start a new hive. And those are called swarms. Now, I've been in swarms, I've been in the middle of swarms. They fly around you, they do not sting, they're just trying to get to a branch or a rock or a tree or something where they can rest around the queen. They ball around her to protect her until scouts go out and try to find a suitable home. And that's why I always left empty hives. So I was hoping they'd go into that.
Sounds like medieval history to me.
It is very feudal, isn't it?
Yeah, what a way to mark your territory. You emerge from your peanut-shaped home and just eliminate anybody who would be a competition and take care of diversity of genes and come back to rule.
There you go. Now, honeybees, as a rule, the worker bees, they can only sting once and then they die. But the queen, she can do whatever she wants.
And Abigail, is it true? As far as I know, depending on how this bee is raised and what she's fed with, she becomes a queen or an ordinary.
That is truth. It's jelly. That is comes from the top of a worker's head, and that's how they feed the babies. When the queen leaves a baby, it looks like a little rice pellet in a cell, and the workers will go around cleaning up debris, any kind of defecation, any of that. They're very clean insects. They do not like any kind of dirt in their hive. And they will take jelly from their heads, and they will put it into that cell for that little piece of rice, turn into a larvae, and then it will eventually turn into a bee. At some process, depending on how large the larvae is, and then they cap it. They cap it, and they don't bother again. But the more of this jelly that they put into a cell, that determines what is a queen. And that's why people eat this jelly, because they feel it has beneficial and effects to them, so they eat it. You can get it at any kind of health food store. Now, how they get that jelly out of those bees, I have no idea.
What strikes me here, it's deeply metaphorical here, because we as children, if we're fed good things, meaning if we're taught to believe in ourselves, if we're supported by our caregivers, if they got the the good stuff out of their head to feed us, right? Then we can practically be unlimited. We can be queens and kings. And if we're taught from young age that we're worthless, and we're not given opportunities, then we're gonna have a much harder life.
Well, there's equal opportunity in a hive, which is not equitable to human life. We live in two different systems. One is equitable, guided by instinct and laws of nature, and the other one is psychology, emotion, and opportunity. And that's the difference.
What is Worker Bee Press?
Worker Bee Press is my printing company. It's my company that I use to publish my books, to do all the work that has to do with publishing. You just don't publish a book and leave it alone. There are a lot of legal things you have to do for it. So that's my legal entity, is Worker Bee Press.
And through it, you produce printed books, ebooks, and audiobooks.
Yes. And as you know, with your publishing company, there's a lot of work that goes into that.
I've always wanted to do audiobooks and I haven't yet produced any of those. But my question is, what sells best to what kind of reader from those three formats?
Well, audio is becoming the more of a success story. And I think in about 5 years' time, AI is going to take over human narration. I think as the, especially in the US, as the population becomes older and people eyesight become weaker, I think more and more people are going to go to audio. Ebooks is the number one money maker at this moment. Print books are slowly making a comeback, but it's e-books and Amazon's the winner.
What kind of activities can authors do to promote their books?
Oh gosh, well, 50% of my time is taken up with marketing. It's very stressful because all I want to do is write. But if I don't get my name out there, if I don't do Facebook, if I don't join sites, promote on sites that promote discounted books, my name doesn't get out there. If I don't do book fairs, my name doesn't get out there. You have to keep a constant appearance. I would say, now I tell you one thing I really dislike about the publishing business is that all these free books that authors are authoring is glutting the market. And I had my own personal assistant tell me, "Oh, I haven't bought a book in a year. I just get free books." Well, that's terrible. That's terrible. Why should our authors who are artists give their books away? I mean, just sell it for 99 cents if you want to do a promotion. But that hurts. But I would tell you the big name right now is BookFunnel and BookBub and Facebook. And if you don't do any of those, you're not going to be out there. I'm trying to conquer TikTok and Blue Sky at the moment. And yeah, I do TikTok. I just start clicking through all the things and I forget what I was supposed to be doing. So it's hard to keep focus when you get on TikTok. But Blue Sky is very big right now. It's eclipsing. I think it will eclipse Facebook eventually for authors. A lot of people still use X. I don't. But there are platforms out there that you can become very prominent on. We'll go out to lunch sometime and we'll talk about it.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to. I have one last question for you. Do you ever give yourself break between projects?
Yeah, I have to. It's just writing is very hard, and I know you understand this. Writing is lonely, it's very stressful. You have to make sacrifices with your time because you've got a deadline you have to meet. I'm a month behind Murder Under a Bitter Moon because I've had all these health issues and it's pushed me back. And all I do is think of night, I've got to get that book finished. I got to get that book finished. And it's very, very stressful. And if you want to make money, you got to push those books out. And but I try to write, I try to have a good product, a good mystery, something that people will enjoy. But people don't understand what goes into writing it. They just don't understand.
It's true that writing is hard and it's stressful when you're behind on a project and that's all you can think and you're anxious. I get all that and I'm there whenever I'm with a project. However, I have found that I'm lost without a project.
I feel the same way. If I go, okay, let's say I take a 3 week break. I just gotta get away from it. After 3 weeks, I start getting the itch. I start getting the itch. And of course my husband says, get back to the computer. Write another book. I understand the itch that all writers have. And I took a class with Gurney Norman when he was teaching at UK. And he called me into his office one time and he said, I think if you stuck to it, I think I was 22 at the time. And he goes, if you stick to it, I think you could write something that people would want to read. He goes, but you got to stick to it and not lose your way. And I understood what he was telling me. And so that's what I always tried to do. I wrote many series. Books before I hit upon Josiah and Mona, and they were not as successful. One, because I didn't know what I was doing, and number two, I didn't know how to promote. And it's not that the books were bad, they just didn't capture the reader's imagination. So if you believe in yourself, you just gotta stick to it.
Abigail, I really appreciate your time and your insight. Thank you so much, and best of luck with all the books.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and give me a call. We'll go out and do lunch.
I would love that.